When theater gypsy and teacher Ingrid DeSanctis came into my office for the first time, she started right in telling me her life story. And I said, stop, 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 until I start taping.
Okay, the life story.
Yeah.
So I grew up in New Jersey, and my father was a Pentecostal preacher. And it was during the hippie movement, no, the Jesus movement, where my siblings and I, there were four of us, we were surrounded by hippies and tent revivals, and we would be dragged to the boardwalk and to pass out tracts while my dad, like, you know, stood on a soapbox literally with a PA system preaching. And my sister and I would always kind of disappear and go to the bathroom for a really long time and come back, you know, because you're at the boardwalk and you recognize kids from school and there you are with these cartoon papers. But that was from our early age, though. I mean, it's a crazy, wild upbringing in many ways, but right away I understood the power of gathering, people gathering, and the holiness about that. And there's a lot of things about the church environment that is theater and theatrical. And my father was Italian. He was very theatrical and would preach for a long time. I held on to that holiness of getting people in a room and quiet. And I think still theater might be one of the only places today still where people gather and turn off electronics and engage quietly. Even church, I see people texting each other like, where are you sitting? I'll meet you up there, or kids. But in the theater, it's still one of the last places we ask a group of people to gather together and be quiet.
You're now
older.
Yes. Oh, yes.
Oh, yes.
It does happen, doesn't it? And you are a theater person.
Yes.
Give me the bridge from little girl hiding out in the bathroom Pentecostal tracks to
yes.
now.
Well, we did also have one of those family stories where everything fell apart. And so my family, we moved to Florida, and then I was a social work major because I did not take theater seriously as a serious life option. But I loved the stage. I knew how to perform probably from the time I was little and loved being up front. So I had
applause or attention.
Applause. I think I liked holding all that magic, that moment. I like that moment where you're up there and you are actually feeling that amazing creative, I don't want to say power, thrill of moving a room. And you can feel the move, you know.
Connection?
Connection. Honesty. I remember the first time I felt it was playing Helen Keller. In that moment where she says water at the end.
Wow, wow.
Yes, I know. It's easy to make fun of, but there is this moment
yeah.
that you feel like, wow, something just happened.
I was not making fun. I think it's one of the great moments in theater.
Do you know how many people made fun of me for that, though, Martha?
Oh, they do.
Oh, my gosh. They would do wah-wah over and over. But I think you get it then, that
yeah.
idea. That one word, you felt this ripple go through. And then once you feel that, it's why I think acting is so beautiful. It's this relationship you have with this group of people that you get to move them, take them on a journey. And obviously, I also love the connection and the work with other actors. But that moment where you feel this room together move, oh, it's just beautiful. But I never took it seriously. And then I had a professor, Barbara Graber. It's amazing how one voice can change your life.
Yes.
One voice. And that's also when I fell in love with what it meant to be a teacher. Because I have been that voice for students where you affirm their gift and it's a really beautiful moment. But somebody did that with me. And she said, you're going to end up in the arts, Ingrid. You're going to end up a theater artist. And I was like, no, I'm not. I'm a social work major. And sure enough, 5 years later, I was in grad school getting my MFA in acting.
Where was college?
College was Eastern Mennonite College.
Okay.
When it was not a university.
All right.
I was very sentimental, followed my sister there, just kind of didn't know what I was going to do. But grew up believing, you know, we got to be good to people, help them. Social
yeah.
work made sense. And then I traveled with Up With People. Have you heard of Up With People?
Of course I've heard of Up With People.
It's just too much like, oh, it sounds like I'm trying to change the world, but I gravitated
There's
to
nothing
things
wrong
that did.
With that.
I really did.
The world needs change.
I believe it. I do believe it. And for 3.5 years, I traveled with them. First as a student, we went all over the world, and my mind exploded with what was possible. It just really, between the cultures and the people, and you're around people that are really want to make a difference in the world. And I started to ask myself, who am I really and what do I really want to do?
Now, let me ask you, your mind exploded. You're performing with people in front of
crowds across the world. Basically.
Very different culture.
Yes.
Are you connecting with those crowds?
Yeah, it's so interesting you ask that, because I wasn't a key performer in that, because it was music and singing and dancing, most of it. And I'm not a singer. I'm not the triple threat in that category. I don't sing and I do not dance. On my own I do, but not on stage. And so there still was this magic with the people. And Up With People is about, you stay with host families after, and it's this relationship that happens to an audience. Again, you are singing songs about changing the world, about issues in the world. In Europe, they went crazy for Up With People, and in Mexico, but not always in America. But you'd look out, and everybody's holding their lighters, and it's like, you know, feel like you're the Beatles. But again, exactly that. There is this thing, this movement in the room, and to be part of that movement just was, I just knew that's where I want to be. And so I thought, you know, I'm not going to be a singer or dancer, but I'm an actor. And I want to just see, can I get into grad school? And I was shocked when I got into a few grad programs. And then I went to University of North Carolina in Greensboro. It was bliss for 3 years. I couldn't believe it. I was studying theater. I couldn't believe it.
So in graduate school,
yes,
how'd you change?
Oh, wow.
As an actor, as a theater person.
This was a very powerful transformation, I think, when I started to understand this idea that the arts transform what can often be misinterpreted as broken or difficult into something beautiful. And that process is, for me, when it became art. For instance, as an actor, my instrument is my body, my voice, my memory, my soul, my heart, all of it. You use everything when you're an actor. And I studied Meisner technique, which is an amazing technique about listening. And my acting teacher...
Go into that a little bit,
well,
so in case people
yes,
aren't familiar
Sanford
with it.
Meisner took the Stanislavski, you know, the approach that was used and changed contemporary acting into more psychological acting. And Meisner really distilled it into this connection and listening through repetition drills and a series of improvisations that allow you to really be in the moment. Stay in the moment and the truth of the moment. And that changed me. It's a, you know, it's one of those gifts of being in the arts. You are not just changed as an artist, you're changed as a human being when you get that. What does it mean to be in the moment? But when you have a teacher that every time you're not in the moment is telling you you're lying, and you're like, I'm not lying, but I don't believe you, Ingrid. I don't believe you. And I learned a few things about the thrill of having someone ask more of you, more than you think you can possibly give. And that changed me a lot, because that I had a teachers that did that over and over. But when I learned in an acting class, that teacher, John Gully, is so magical. He would get you to tell the worst stories of your life and turn it into something where everyone in the room is laughing. Or, you know, I told this horrible story that I'm not even going to go into about my father and all this stuff that happened when I was a this story happened when I was a kid. First, I never told anybody because I had some sort of embarrassment about it. Next, I'm telling the whole class. We're all laughing and I'm done. And the teacher says, Ingrid, that is one of the most incredible stories I've ever heard. Look what happened to the room. And I realized this thing of the power of us revealing ourselves, of what it means to truly reveal, how you actually, that's such a generous action. And I have a lot of trouble when people misunderstand actors as selfish or self-possessed, because truly to go out on the stage and give all of yourself, to decide I'm going to open so wide so that something happens for you, so that something is moved in this room if I open. Not indulgently, artistically, so that you get something. That is so amazing.
You have been quite a gypsy.
I think my gypsiness is a 4-year cycle, usually. At least my therapist and I, we've worked through this. Maybe you should cut that. But we have figured out my rotation is 4 years. And why do I do that? In some ways, I think there is a difficult tension. I am so curious. about the world and what's next. I'm so curious that it's not that I get bored easily, but I do gravitate to what's impossible, and I want to do it.
Back after a break to talk with Ingrid DeSanctis about her new play. This is The Spark. I'm Martha Woodruff. Theater person Ingrid DeSanctis loves teaching. She hopes to open doors for her students in the same way teachers open doors for her. On a whim, a while ago, Ingrid came back to Harrisonburg. Her whims, she says, have served her well. And this whim enmeshed her in a creative project with an old friend and former guest on The Spark, Sarah Elizabeth Farris.
Again, I followed that wind, you know, the door opened and you go, where is that? And you have an idea. And I wanted to just be back in Harrisonburg, and a dear former student of mine, dear friend, Sarah Elizabeth Farris, is she was my assistant when I was a new professor. I say this about her. I mean, she was right there when I made many mistakes. You know, some days where you think you're better than you really are, she saw that. You know, she saw me. And some days she said this to me one time, that she goes, Ingrid, sometimes we thought you were either a genius or you were crazy. I don't want to know.
There we go.
So I can answer that myself. Let's just pretend they thought I was a genius. But let's face it, you know, when you're learning. Who needs labels? There we go. But she became this really dear, wonderful, incredibly different than me kind of woman to be around. And she was my assistant. And we became friends, you know, over the last 15 years. And about a year and a half ago, she found out she had liver cancer. First, it started as ocular melanoma in her cancer of her eye. She thought she was fine for 4 years. And then she goes to the doctor and finds out it had gone to her liver. And that is really bad news. And immediately, she says this is how I coped. Immediately, I was like, I want to write a play, Sarah. And she told me later, she was like, okay, Ingrid's grieving. This is what she wants to do. She's going to create something, write a play. So I started a play about a year and a half ago.
Sounds like something Sarah would do.
That's right. Yeah. You know Sarah. That's right. And she let me write it. And then I wrote some of it. And we read it. And then another probably 6 months had passed. And she really, her journey is pretty amazing. You know, she's beating the statistics that said 6 to 8 months. She's almost 2 years now. And then this summer, I said, I'm really going to finish that play. And I got these new ideas about it and got very clear about it and finished it. And then in, I think it was October, they took out her ovary. The cancer showed up there. And I remember writing an email. I was too emotional about it to call her on the phone. And I said, I think we need to do the play while you're okay. And I had this vision. I want this play produced while she is healthy, can sit in the audience and then come up afterwards and talk about her life. And so she wrote back, okay. I said, well, let's produce it in the spring. Martha, I have no idea what I'm saying. You know, I had no idea. At that point, I was in transition. I wasn't even going to be in Harrisonburg. I was just talking. And so thinking, and I'm a believer, and sometimes you say it, it's going to happen. You know, sometimes you talk your way into things. You start claiming it when you put it outside of your mouth and it hits the air, you know. But here I am, Sarah, we're going to produce it. Where, how, when, whatever. And the momentum has happened. And we've got ourselves into this thing where we have it pretty much cast. We're producing it at Eastern Mennonite University is gifting us the space. And then in Stanton, the Shannon Arts are gifting us the space, and we're premiering it in March and then producing it again in April. And we had, you know, the Emily Scherer from the Daily News Record of Harrisonburg wrote a story about us, and Then they put it on the front page, and we were just giggling, like, what is happening? This started with me sending an email. I think we should do this. And I looked at Sarah and I guess said, I guess we're really doing this now.
We're doing it. Tell me about the play.
The play. Well, there are a lot of cancer plays out there. And you can't worry about repeating a story because stories come up in many forms. But I studied Sarah's blogs and started reading those. And Sarah has a magical, funny, blunt, honest way of dealing with cancer. And I thought, how do we tell that story? And she's also a magical Montessori school teacher, has been. And it came to me, what if cancer appears as a dinosaur to her? And it's this quirky, weird, sweet dinosaur that feels bad that it's so hungry, but keeps following her around.
What better way to capture the sense of Ingrid De Sanctis' play, which incidentally is called Sarah and the Dinosaur, than to hear a reading of a couple of scenes?
I'm going to be reading Sarah today, and Kirsten Beachy will be reading the dinosaur, and Braden Hoover will be reading Charlie. The first scene we're going to do is a scene where Sarah meets the dinosaur. It shows up in her dream. And she talks about how she has all these kinds of dreams. She's a reoccurring dreamer, but she doesn't recognize this dinosaur. It's not familiar. And this is a segment of that scene. Why are you here?
I'm on your mind, in your heart, in your brain. I'm all you think about. So here I am.
I want to wake up.
You need your sleep. You have cancer.
Yeah, I do. Wait, cancer, how did you...
I'm so hungry.
What is your name?
I don't know.
How can you not know your name?
Okay, I'm Dinosaur.
I know what you are. You used to be in my eye. Now you're in my liver. Why did you go to my liver?
I like to travel. And I was hungry.
I don't like you. And I like most people, and I don't like you. I think I hate you, actually.
Actually, don't hate me. I'm in you. We should try to be friends.
Friends?
Yeah. Do you have any Cheetos?
Oh, damn you. I'm waking up. Go away.
Everyone responds this way.
I don't care how everyone responds. I didn't invite you into my body. I don't want to be like everyone else, and I don't want to feed you.
I don't like being me either.
Oh, you are not getting my sympathy.
I think we'll end up friends. You're kind of fierce and fiery, and I'm here. I don't want to be here, but I am.
Guess what? I'm not going to sleep anymore. I'm not going to sleep. I'm going to stay awake for weeks, and I don't want to see you in that weird purple dinosaur costume.
I'm here now, whether you're sleeping or awake.
Yeah, I get that. Just give me a minute. I want to sleep. I want to dream, and not about you. And if you're hungry, Cheetos are in the kitchen cabinet. This next scene is a scene between Charlie and Sarah. Charlie is her, what she calls, unhusband, the boyfriend she's not going to marry. And after years of being together, Charlie has invited Sarah to move in with him. After years of dating where he swore, I'm going to be alone, alone, alone. This is the day he invites her. This is a segment of that scene. Well, I'd like to make it a bit girly in here. Not too much, but I would like to look at some fluffy dresses while I lay here recovering. Some pink. I would like some pink.
Okay.
I'll be lying here a lot, you know, when they take out half my liver.
Okay.
How are you about gross things?
Great. Yeah. I'm great with gross things. I love gross things.
Okay.
Like bugs and blood and scars and surgery. I love gross things.
Okay.
I mean, that's why I want you to move in, really. Because I love all gross things.
It's going to be gross. You know, you're going to have to work out. I mean, you need to beef up if you're going to carry me when I'm sick, when I can't walk, when half my liver is gone.
I know.
But I have my limits.
Of course.
You can't do my bedpans. You can't get close to poop or peeing or any of that.
Okay.
I still need to be your princess. I need to see you that way, even if I look really bad. I want to make sure you still see me as you did. That's why all the pink. Good pink. Girl pink.
Okay.
I'm not going to cry.
Me either.
Just so you know, I won't marry you.
I know.
I don't want you to get my debt when I die, you know, in case I go on a spending frenzy.
I get it. So?
What?
Will you move in with me?
Wow. That's kind of like, will you marry me?
Yeah, it is.
Ask me again. And can you get down on one knee and be a real goofball?
Okay. So, will you move in with me?
Yeah.
Good.
There's a moment in the play towards the end, maybe three quarters of the way through, where Sarah explodes at this dinosaur and just leaves the dinosaur alone on stage with the audience.
I know I'm not a sympathetic character. I know I'm not written that way, and I'm not wanted at any dinner parties, and people hate to mention my name. I'm not funny, and I would guess most of you would run if I came near you. No doctor can figure out how to get rid of me, and I show up way too often in way too many of you, and, well, I am not a sympathetic character. But, well, I guess I hope somebody figures it out. It's hard being cancer. If I was the flu, you can take a shot. Even if I was an STD, and I've met him and he is a sleazebag. But you can take some pills, a shot, and most of them go away. But with me, with cancer, nobody can figure us out. So I'm stuck. Come on, don't look at me like that. I mean, the Ice Age took care of Tyrannosaurus Rex. Certainly something has to come along to send us away. But for now, I'm still here. Sorry.
This next scene is a night. Sarah's gone to bed, and in the dark, she hears something at the end of her bed, and it's Charlie. And they have a conversation, and he admits how he really feels.
I'm scared.
Okay.
The cancer scares me.
Okay.
And I didn't want to tell you that I was scared with the lights on. I thought it wasn't right for me to be scared. You have the cancer, after all, not me. You. It lives in your body and follows you, and you are the one. The one that, I don't know, deals with it, has it, holds it every day. It's not right for me to be scared.
Okay.
I'm scared of what my world would look like, what it would be like. You're kind of funny and crazy and say what you think and like pink and are peculiar, and if you, well, it would get quiet and gray. If
I die.
Yeah.
When I die. Okay, that's too much silence. I can't see your eyes. I need you to turn the lights on.
Wait, just one more thing.
Okay. One more. Then we have to turn the lights on.
Okay, I promise. One more thing. At the risk of sounding like a song from the 1980s, I have something to tell you. You light up my life. I know, it's so Debbie Boone, but I like you. A lot. No. You know I love you. And I didn't work out, and I'm not good at carrying you, but I hold you. Close. Beautiful you. Only you. Just you. Cancer and all. Right here.
Where? I can't see you.
Here. My heart. And it's broken. I can feel it. The pain. I feel it broken. It is physical pain. In some cultures, people hold the pain in their throats, but I hold it here, in my heart. Here in my broken heart.
Hold me. Here. Come here.
Sarah and the Dinosaur premieres March 14th at the Lee Eshelman Studio Theater at Eastern Mennonite University. There's a link with lots of additional information about the play on the Spark page at WMRA.org.